Outbeat Radio, a program that focuses on issues by and for and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Greer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight we have Josh Simmons and Chris Neugebauer, together for 7 years, married for almost four. Josh is a bi, disabled white man and spends his privilege on advocacy work and community service locally and globally. He is a volunteer board member with Petaluma Pride and Open Source Initiative. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
And Chris has spent much of his time working on making the tech community more inclusive and welcoming. He has been a volunteer board member at the Python Software Foundation and was director of North Bay Python, a queer-organized tech conference at Petaluma's Mystic Theater. In his copious work time, he is a software engineer at Toolchain. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a delight to have both of you.
Exactly. So stay tuned to learn more about Chris and Josh. But first, here's news and events from our Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of March 6th, 2022. LGBTQ Ukrainians captured a group of AWOL Russian soldiers hiding in a basement in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. LGBT activist Viktor Polipenko said that the soldiers didn't realize the basement they had chosen to hunker down in was also the office of the local LGBTQ group. Polipenko, a veteran who rejoined the army last week to aid in Ukrainian defense from Russia, said the LGBTQ group members both beat and captured the soldiers. He said, quote, "We're confronting a tyrannical, homophobic enemy." Since Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion, LGBTQ Ukrainians have been terrified for their future. While Ukraine doesn't fully recognize LGBTQ people, the country has come a lot further than Russia, where LGBTQ people continue to be actively persecuted. The U.S. has also revealed that Russia has a kill list of Ukrainians it plans to murder or detain. This list includes several LGBTQ people. But as in the case with so many Ukrainian citizens right now, LGBTQ Ukrainians are stepping up to fight. Veronika Lamina, for example, who works at an NGO that promotes LGBTQ rights in the military and has been running a camp to teach LGBTQ volunteer cadets the skills they need to fight. And here in the U.S. in New York, a 74-year-old Long Island man who was accused of sending grisly and threatening letters to LGBTQ people and organizations over a period of many years has finally pled guilty to criminal charges. Retired high school teacher Robert Faring admitted his guilty plea last Wednesday and said that he sent letters threatening large-scale violence, including bombings and shootings, over an 8-year period beginning in 2013. He now faces up to 5 years in prison. His attorney Glenn Obedin told Newsday, quote, "Mr. Faring is relieved to have completed this phase of the process and will now prepare himself for the final stage," end quote. Currently free on $100,000 bond, his sentencing will take place on June 17th. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, one of Faring's letters, quote, "threatened that there would be radio-controlled devices placed at numerous strategic places," end quote, at the 2021 New York City Pride March. And he went on to say that the firepower would make the 2016 Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting look like a cakewalk. And in Texas, LGBTQ Nation reports that at least two Texas county attorneys have declared that they will not uphold Governor Greg Abbott's recent demand that the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services investigate parents who support their transgender children. Christian Jemanafee said on Twitter, quote, "As a lawyer who represents Department of Protective Services in child abuse cases in Harris County, I can tell you my office will not be participating in this political game," end quote. Manafee went on to say, quote, "We'll continue to follow the laws on the books, not Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's politically motivated and legally wrong opinion," end quote. In a more official statement, Manafee lambasted both Governor Abbott and Paxton for ignoring medical professionals and intentionally misrepresenting the law to the detriment of transgender children and their families. He declared that they will follow the laws on the books rather than the opinions, and said, quote, "We owe a duty of candor to the courts about what the law really says," end quote. And here locally in the Bay Area, the Rainbow Honor Walk, located in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood, which posthumously recognizes LGBTQ history-making pioneers, has announced its third class of inductees who will receive sidewalk tributes in the neighborhood. These tributees include Bob Ross, the co-founder and publisher of the Bay Area Reporter, jazz great Billie Holiday, trans leader Marsha P. Johnson, and marriage equality advocate Edie Windsor. The project, which started in 2014, now has 36 plaques installed throughout the Castro, according to a news release from the all-volunteer board, with another 8 scheduled for placement this spring. In 2021, the board unanimously selected San Francisco lesbian trailblazer Phyllis Lyon, who died in 2020. The board now begins the process of raising about $150,000 to install the plaques. Each one costs about $6,000 to fabricate and install.
If you have a local LGBTQ news story, announcement, or an event you'd like to share with our listeners in this segment, tell us about it by going to our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click the Submit Event button at the top of the page. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Morelli.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana Sheridan. As our guests tonight, we have Josh Simmons and Chris Neugebauer, and we really appreciate both of you taking your times out of your busy schedules to be with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's a pleasure.
I just want to say, I was reading Facebook, and that's when I came across Josh and Chris's story and about their marriage. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you don't mind. I would love to know about what we were reading about.
Yeah, so the Petaluma Argus Courier did a series of profiles for their sort of Valentine's Day edition of the newspaper. And they were looking to profile somebody not so heteronormative. And they found us. And it was really special. We did an interview and got to tell the story of how we met each other and how we landed in Petaluma. And it was something special. You know, we tell that story pretty often to friends and family. But I think this is the first time that our story has really been shared much more publicly.
And I'm grateful we have a newspaper article that we can share. Will save us some time in the future, I imagine.
Well, we have a lot of time right now, and I did not see the newspaper article, and I bet there's some people listening that haven't seen it. So would you mind just telling us your story?
Yes. So I have been a public speaker at conferences in the tech software development community for coming on 10 years now, slightly more than 10 years, in fact. I've lost track of time over the course of the last few years, and who hasn't? And one of the events that I regularly spoke at was an event run by O'Reilly Media, who are a Sebastopol-based technical publisher. They used to run conferences. One of those was in Portland, which I attended every year since 2011. And at some point, Josh got hired by O'Reilly.
That's right. I was working at O'Reilly Media as a community manager. And part of my role was to know the people who were there, the speakers, the sponsors, the community members, make sure everybody felt comfortable, connected, like they were getting their needs met. And so first night on the job at this conference, and to set the scene, this was a 4,200 person conference. And I was fairly new to community managing. And so I was just like deer in headlights. I land at Portland Airport, I get a cab or take the, you know, their light rail, whatever it was. And I remember walking into the sort of official conference hotel. And I look off to my left, where like they've got the restaurant and the bar and all that. And I could see a lot of my colleagues and a lot of familiar faces, including a gaggle of Australians who I knew to be speakers and authors with O'Reilly. And I thought, well, I'm here. I guess it's time to do my job. I sat myself down with them and started some unlikely friendships.
Why do you say unlikely?
Well, you know, it's not unlikely. we had chemistry, don't get me wrong, but we're from other sides, like opposite ends of the world, right? And
also you've got 4,500 people to give your attention to. So the amount of time that you spent having a chat with myself and the friends of mine who were sitting around at the hotel lounge was probably more than you would have expected.
Yeah, that's probably true. So this was July of 2014, that first night. And I was, this is a week long event, I should say. So it is like full throttle all week long. The deer in headlights feeling did not go away for me. I was just constantly overwhelmed. And part of that overwhelm kept me from noticing the disproportionate attention that I was getting from Chris here. So we had gone and gotten coffee. We had gone and gone to, one of the really famous bottle shops there. And I just didn't even think about it twice. I just thought, sure, I'm just building a friendship with somebody here at the conference. This is part of my job. Well, when we parted ways the Friday of that year, we didn't stop talking. And I should say, this is significant. This is significant for me because so long as my job has been sort of heavily on the social media and communication side, I don't really chat online anymore. It feels like work. So I didn't do much of it. But Chris here kept me talking all year. And by the time we saw each other in 2015.
Yeah, decided we'd make a pretty effective product. So we embark on a long distance relationship as it was. And I used the opportunities that came with sort of regularly attending and speaking at tech conferences to be in the same place as somebody who had reason to be at number of tech conferences on this side of the world. And so I spent much of late 2015 and 2016 going back and forth across the Pacific a few times. So a lot of time spent on planes that year. On one of those trips, we eventually came to the conclusion that one of us was going to have to move, and that ended up being me.
Part of the long distance relationship is it forced us to communicate more than we might otherwise. We really couldn't take much for granted. And so we were very open with each other about, well, here's the range of possibilities. This could be nothing. This could be an occasional thing. Or we could, if we feel good about this, which we did, the next step is to live together, and immigration being what it is.
Yeah, because that's a big deal. I mean, to make that decision and which one's going to go where,
How did you decide that Chris would come to America?
So firstly, how did we make that decision? It was pretty clear to me that the job opportunities for me in America, at least, were probably going to be more easy to come by where I was in my career compared with where Josh was in his career. And the opportunities that he was able to exploit were more readily available in America, which is true for both of us. And we also wanted to make sure that our respective immigration processes weren't tied to working at a particular place. Because having a relationship beholden to a single employer is a really terrible power dynamic to have. And as it was, the circumstances in the States made it such that it was possible for us to pursue family immigration should we get married. And that was not an option that was available to us in Australia at the time. So it was basically a combination of both the ability for us both to, work on our careers, build a life in the same place, but also that the immigration pathways were significantly simpler on this side of the pond than it was over in Australia.
To put it plainly, Australia took a few years longer than the United States did to federally recognize same-sex marriage.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So I want to back up a little bit because I want to know, what was that attraction, Chris? You didn't mention the attraction. What made you just hone in on Josh over there?
That's not a question I've been asked very often.
That's a great question.
It is a great question. Well, firstly, Josh, it, Josh is naturally very, very charming. He has the ability to command a room quite effectively and give people the attention that they should be given. And he's a fantastic meeting facilitator for that, if you want to start talking about some of his lesser known talents later on. But he is generally pretty charming and inquisitive, was good at asking questions about things. We spent a lot of time talking about the terrible state of Australian politics at the time, that first evening in 2014. And I think Josh knew more about the state of Australian politics than I think he expected to, because those were the questions that got asked.
What he's not saying is that I'm also extremely cute.
It is true.
He got tripped up a little bit. Did you notice that, Josh?
I always get tripped up. I'm terrible at the extemporaneous speaking, especially when I get thrown by a completely unexpected question like that one. Gosh,
love you, dear.
Oh, that was sweet.
Well, let me ask you, Josh. I mean, in hindsight now, what was it about Chris that made you give him more time than the rest of the 4,500 people at the conference? What was it?
Well, first of all, he's extremely cute. Doesn't hurt. You know, I think Chris is, I will say this, I know many Australians now, and I love them all very much. Chris, I think, is the only Australian I've met who never tried to play a prank on me. You know, they're like pranks that they play on tourists, right? Like there's the myth of the drop bear, or they're just weird things that folks will say to tourists. And Chris was always really respectful in that way. And you know, I am a person who has described myself in the past as painfully earnest. And so depending on who I'm interacting with, that can come across as extremely gullible, because I believe people. I take them at face value. That's just
certainly one of the aspects of your character that I really appreciate.
Yeah, so there was that, and he was persistent, and he was kind and thoughtful and attentive.
Really beautiful. Beginning. What a beginning, right? Nice.
So something that's missing out of your story is you talked, you chatted, you texted for a year. When did you decide you were boyfriends before Chris returned back to Australia, or how did that come about?
So I should say, first of all, that I was very deliberately not looking for love, especially not in a place where I was working. I am so wary of forming romantic relationships in that context because it is just so fraught. And so initially, to my great shame these days, initially I was like, hey, this is lovely, but I don't really want to be public about this. I was out. So it wasn't that, but it was just like, hey, this is weird. Like, I want to kind of feel this out and be confident in it before we tell the world. So we knew by the time Chris and I left Portland in 2015 that there was something there, mm-hmm. but we weren't putting labels on it yet. I think it was probably October of that year when things had escalated in a wonderful way, when it's like, well, we are clearly an item. There's no hiding this anymore. And, you know, we had a number of trips together. And I just remember, you know, again, we had to keep we had to be open about what the range of possibilities were for us and, you know, what our constraints were. And I remember having the conversation about, hey, you know, if we want to take this to the next step, this is what it's going to take. And we just kind of left it at that. We didn't feel like we needed to force a decision in that moment. We just needed to be communicative with each other. And it was later in that trip when Chris caught me with a ridiculous grin and read my mind a little bit and said, no, not right now. Not this moment. Because in that moment, I was like, well, look, I'm ready. I'm in. I'm all in. Let's do this. Let's get engaged. But he stopped me in that moment. And I'm glad he did, because we then found ourselves in Portland again. Mm-hmm. And we had a lovely dinner with some friends. And you know, one of the things we love about Portland is walking it. So we were on a long walk back to our accommodation. And you just tell that, like, we were inching up to the moment. And we sauntered onto the Steel Bridge, which is not the most glamorous bridge in Portland, but it's a very special bridge for us. First of all, because it is multimodal and we are transit nerds. Mm-hmm. And also because that is the place where we actually mutually proposed to each other.
No, we both realized it was the right moment at the same time. And so, yeah.
That's beautiful. Like the timing was just perfect, right? When you're there together instead of on the phone or the Zoom or whatever. Yeah. How special. Thank you for sharing that story with me.
So getting back to moving to the United States, Chris, how is that for you? I mean, it's been 4 years, 5 years or so.
Yeah, coming up on 5 years, actually, like 5 years in 2 weeks' time, I guess.
Yeah.
So quite a milestone in that respect. I found the move surprisingly easy. The part of California that Josh has brought me to reminds me a lot of the part of Australia that I'm from, right down to the trees. A lot of Tasmanian eucalypts in Northern California. So that made it easy. And the people here are super friendly and the community was welcoming to me. So it was not a huge amount of culture shock, especially since I'd spent a good proportion of the previous 6 years before I moved visiting here at least once a year, generally twice or three times. So it wasn't the hardest of moves. You know, it was still difficult moving away from somewhere I'd spent most of my life and leaving friends behind and that, but it was worth it.
Nice hearing that, huh, Josh?
Huge relief. There really is a striking similarity in the sense of place that we have here with the region around Hobart and Tasmania.
Yeah, I can't, this is obviously a radio show and I can't tell your listeners what it is that your hosts are looking at just over my right shoulder here, but there's a bunch of photo prints on canvases from various parts of the world. And some of them look like landscapes of a summer in Sonoma County, and know they're not there. They're from, you know, an hour north of where I used to live just before I moved away. So the landscapes are similar. You would be hard pressed to tell whether or not they were Californian or Tasmanian, unless you looked at like the color of the paint on the road or whatever.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned immigration and family immigration. Talk a little bit about that.
So after we got engaged, we started looking into what the options available to us were and discovered that the option that was easiest for us was to use what's called a fiancé visa, which was a way that they put in place after the Vietnam War for all the vets to bring their Vietnamese fiancés over to the US without the vagaries of the US immigration system, which take forever. Where basically you can go through the process of getting a visa, fly over and marry within 90 days and then apply immediately for permanent residency. And if you're paying close enough attention, mentioned at the start of the show that we say that we've been married for 4 years, but I moved here 5 years ago. We, you know, 2 days after moving here, went to the registrar's office in Sonoma County and got the quickest, most legally acceptable wedding we could possibly get for the purposes of getting a marriage certificate, and then shut up about it for the next 14 months while we, you know, actually got settled and, you know, got into a position where we were ready for my family to come and visit, which we wouldn't have been in the first 2 months of me moving here. And I sort of needed to get that aspect of things done so that I could, you know, do things that society here requires, like, you know, apply for a job, which I couldn't do until immigration processed that paperwork, which required the marriage certificate. And so we went through the process of getting legally married, but we're very clear that this was, you know, just doing the legal step before we did the emotional step, which was getting committed in front of family and friends, which we did in May the following year.
That's right.
So what I'm hearing you say is you did it for work and your ability to get a job if you were married, but it wasn't quite...
My ability to not get deported, honestly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I gathered. Yeah.
I don't think either of us, when we met, were searching for like, here's who I'm going to marry. You mm-hmm. know, neither of us set out with that. And frankly, we're both of a kind where we would probably take our time with such a decision.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the constraints being what they were, the only way to take our relationship to the next level was to get married before we might have otherwise mm-hmm. gone down that path. And so we did it knowing that we had to even explore whether this was really going to be a properly long-term thing. So, you know, on the one hand, the legal system forced our hands, right? But also, we wouldn't have done it if we didn't have the confidence that, you know, this might work out.
It wasn't a marriage to facilitate immigration. We got married because we wanted to, and the immigration was an important aspect of that. But it sort of just changed the time at which things happened.
Yeah.
But the whole immigration process has actually gone surprisingly well. I'm interviewing for naturalization, not next week, but the week after. So that'll be exciting.
What kind of things will they be asking you in the interview?
Oh, so the difficult ones have actually come and gone. So in 2018, actually before our public wedding, but after our legal wedding, which was a hilarious process to have to explain to an immigration officer who is looking for evidence that your marriage is not a fraud. They asked a lot of the questions that you've asked us, like how we met and how we decided to get married and how we decided to end up where we did. This is a lot more pleasant than the immigration interview. I can assure you of that.
Were you both in separate rooms?
No, so we're pretty convincing that you observe us for 3 minutes and you realize that we're actually in love. So, you know, yeah, they didn't lock us up and ask us the toothbrush questions and the what side of the bed questions.
Because they do have that level of interviewing as a tool in their tool belt if they suspect that something might be amiss.
But we didn't screw it up that badly.
No. Yeah, they will interview you separately. And it's questions like, what day is the trash taken out? Who sleeps on what side of the bed? And, you know, all this minutia, which we could have answered, but thankfully didn't have to.
They saw starry eyes, yes, and smiles. Yeah, got it.
And the fact that we've traveled, our relationship had been built around travel, meant that there were a lot of photos. There are a lot of like tickets and receipts and hotel receipts. So we had mountains of evidence.
Yeah, the questions for the naturalization interview has like, you know, why is FDR famous? And I've aced every test of the civics quiz that that I've done online. So I feel like I can answer those questions okay.
Oh, best of luck to you in your interview in a couple of weeks. Best of luck to you.
Excited. I'm looking forward to being able to vote for reasons that I'm sure we'll discuss later on in the interview.
We got so much more to do, right? And we got to take a music break right now.
Mm-hmm. It's time for our music break. So, Chris, would you introduce the song that y'all brought and tell us why you brought it?
Yeah. So what you're going to hear is a mashup of two songs. And I'm a huge fan of mashups as an art form because they can show you that bits of two different songs can be brought together to make a whole that is more interesting, more beautiful than the sum of their parts. And this one's by a French producer named Mighty Mike. The vocals you'll certainly recognize. The backing tune is from an English guy named Mika, who you may or may not have heard of. He's a gay singer who was popular 10, 15 years ago. And the sum of these two parts sound really beautiful together. And we actually played it as our walkout music at our wedding back in 2018. And watching the reaction of people in the audience as they worked out what was going on was hilarious. And I've got this wonderful photo of one of our friends, just the real look of realization is captured on her face amazingly. And I'm sure your listeners will be deeply amused once they realize what it is.
Wonderful. What's the name of the song again?
The name of the song is Never Ending.
All right. Enjoy, everyone. Never Ending. And we'll see you on the other side.
We're no strangers to love. You know the rules, and so do full commitment's what I'm thinking of. You wouldn't get this from any other guy. I just wanna tell you how I'm feeling. Gotta make you understand. Never gonna give you up. Never gonna let you down. Never gonna run around and desert you. Never gonna make you cry.
each other for so long. Your heart's been aching, but you're too shy to say it. Inside we both know what's been going on. We know the game and we're gonna play it. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up. Never gonna give. We've known each other for so long. Your heart's been aching, but you're too shy to say it. Inside we both know what's been going on. We know the game and we're gonna play it. I just wanna tell you how I'm feeling. Gotta make you understand. Never gonna give you up. Never gonna let you down. Never gonna run. Never gonna let you down. Never gonna run around and desert you.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diane and Sheridan, and we are in studio with Josh and Chris, and we just listened to this gorgeous song, Never Ending. And you all brought that song, and now we want to know more about that song. Tell us about it.
So yeah, that is a mashup by the French mashup producer Mighty Mike. You probably recognize the vocals as Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley, which is famous for being a pretty generic but catchy 80s pop tune, over the top of a instrumental from a song called Happy Ending by the English singer Mika. And that was the song that we had playing as we walked down the aisle out of our wedding back in 2018.
And what did your guests think of it?
It was hilarious watching the reactions. We did it because it is a song that is genuinely beautiful in that form, and we quite like it. But also just seeing people recognize the song once they figure out what it is, and just seeing the looks of realization on their faces was a priceless moment for us. It was great.
I should offer some more context for listeners, because I doubt all of the listeners are extremely online. And so because we both work in tech, we're both of a certain age, in our 30s, we have a lot of friends who are familiar with this thing called rickrolling, which is where you surprise somebody into listening to Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. Mm-hmm. Our celebrant, in fact, is particularly famous for rickrolling. He operates the international Rick Astley hotline. People are often trying to rickroll him, but he's immune at this point. Anywho, not only is the song beautiful, but once the vocals kick in and our friends and family realize that we were rickrolling them, the laughter, the facial expressions, it's already like a really emotional moment in a lot of ways. And it just made it
it's a great way to break the tension.
It broke the tension and was just that much more special.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. Sounds like a really magic moment.
It was.
And I was rocking it out, you know? I was loving it. Strong presence, so too. Good.
It really is. It's why I love this particular, this art form, is showing how you can bring two songs together to make something that's a more complete whole than either of the parts might have been.
There's probably a metaphor in there that we could roll with and apply to
others
in our life, too.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, this is great. You two are just really special. You have so much going on. So there's so much we want to get to. Is there something else that you want to share about your careers and what you're doing out in the world? That would be special to hear.
Like you said, you're part of it, that you guys are techie and you're online all the time. Like, say more about that.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Shall I talk a bit about our conference organizing experience?
Absolutely.
Because I think that's something that I had been a volunteer conference organizer for a number of years. I think the tech industry is notorious for being very cis white male, which is deeply unfortunate and had been for a long time. And I find that a way to open up opportunities for people is to get them in the same places as where everyone else is and show this homogenous group of people that there are interesting people who are interested in tech, if only you'd notice that they're there. So I've spent a lot of my volunteer time making opportunities for people to be in the same place as everyone else. And when I moved over here, because I had the 3 months of not being allowed to work, thank you, US government, got really deeply into the idea of perhaps running a tech conference in the town to which I had moved, and decided to do that. And aside from Josh, thought about the people who I wanted to organize it. And I'm not sure if it was entirely by accident, but assembled like a team of five people, all of whom happened to be queer, to put together a conference in our wonderful live music venue here in Petaluma, the Mystic Theater, and did that for 3 years running. We've been kind of waylaid by the pandemic, unfortunately, making it difficult to run in-person events. Hopefully next year or sometime we can get back into that. But it's interesting, the tone of an event that's organized by a team that's entirely of a minority is very different to some of the other ones that we've been to. Like the thought that you have to give to inclusion, to making opportunities for people, it's really different. And I've appreciated that perspective compared with some of the less queer organization, like conference organizations I've been involved with.
Could you give us a couple of examples of that, the difference?
So one example of the difference is, I think, being more bold about having confronting material in terms of the talks that people give. And by confronting, I don't necessarily mean like violent or traumatic, but things that get people to think and question the assumptions that they have. I think people who haven't been in an environment where they've had to question their privilege, question the opportunities that they've had, they might look at a talk proposal about, so in our first year, we had a talk about how to accommodate people who are more naturally quiet and less likely to speak up in their work environments. And that's a super valuable topic because a lot of tech people are introverted, and introverted people tend to get fewer promotion opportunities because they're less good at self-promotion. Turns out such people are also less likely to oversell themselves when applying to give a talk. And if you undersell yourselves to somebody who doesn't understand the value of what it is you have to say, you're less likely to get that message out there. And so I feel like having a program committee who are interested in raising up less heard voices made for material like that talk sort of made that appear more, we gave it more space than I think I've seen in other events.
If I could add to that, there's the way that having a queer organizing team impacted the content. Absolutely. Talks about introverted folks and how to support them and be more successful as one of those individuals. But also content questioning assumptions about how do names work? How do addresses work? How do we store gender information in databases? These are questions at the intersection of social models and technology And often these decisions get made with a lot of assumptions packed into them. And so we challenge those assumptions. One of my favorite talks was Shaw Stepter, who gave a presentation called From Prison to Python.
He was a lifer in San Quentin, was arrested and imprisoned when he was 17. And within the first 12 months of him being paroled, he came and gave a talk about how he rebuilt his life within the Californian carceral system.
And paired that with a talk about like why it's important to hire people who have these histories, you know, because the quote unquote criminal justice system so disproportionately impacts people of color, for instance. Well, if we have policies against hiring people with records, that is disproportionately discriminatory against people of color. So, you know, there's the way that having a queer organizing team impacted our content, but it impacted everything else as well. We spent a decent proportion of our budget on scholarships to make sure people could access the event, who could really fully participate. We had open captions so people who were hard of hearing could participate more fully. We documented accessibility requirements or the accessibility sort of landscape of the event, even in places where we knew it was less than ideal. And we wanted to make sure that people with, for instance, mobility issues knew that the bathrooms were going to be a challenge for them. So it's just really being thoughtful about the way that we create a space that is welcoming for everybody.
How did you guys get to be so sensitive to this issue of inclusion of less heard voices? I mean, you're a couple of white guys. You look like you have the world. I mean, why would you care about other people?
I'll speak for myself. So firstly, I had a great opportunity earlier on in my career where I said to the organizer of the big Python conference that is, and Python is this programming language that I use mostly in my day job. They run a big conference, 2,500 people every year. I said to the lead organizer, I want to understand what it is that you do to make this big conference work and be welcoming so I can take it back to Australia and try and do the right thing there. And they paid all my expenses to attend that year. So I had an opportunity where I could experience what this event was like and, you know, pay attention and bring it back home. But I realized that a big part of that was giving people the opportunity to pay it forward. And then, of course, there's, you know, the huge amount of, you know, getting told when I was doing it wrong and taking that on board, because, you know, if people are going to go out of their way to tell me that I'm doing something wrong, it means that they care enough to tell me that I might be able to fix it. And so, you know, actually being able to take people's experiences through a critical lens and like figure out how to incorporate that into what I do. Josh might have a different answer.
I have a very different answer. So for my part, I have lived through some extremes. When I was, I had to be 11, 12 years old, my parents were worried about me. I was depressed. You know, in retrospect, I chalk that up to not understanding my sexuality. I chalk that up to being a person with mental health issues that were as yet undiagnosed. And my parents, my dad in particular, he didn't know what to do. And, you know, he's never been an extremely religious man, but he has seen the power of religion in helping people through tough times. And sure enough, I got sent to a evangelical summer camp, and I took that hook, line, and sinker, because for me, it offered the appearance of certainty. It offered community. It was just so many things that I felt I needed and was in search of. And it had them all on a, you know, a shiny silver platter for me. And so, to be perfectly transparent, at times in my life, I've transited from pretty right-wing views. And one of the reasons I left the church was because I knew that my sexuality was different. And the moment I tried to broach that subject with somebody else in the church, I could tell these were not my people. It was not going to be a safe place for me. And so I began a process of deconstruction, of intentionally turning over every stone I could find in my head, and finding philosophies and traditions and intentionally building a new worldview. And I have struggled. I have friends and family who have struggled. And I just know that I would never wish struggle on anybody. And so my attitude has always been to listen and see and learn and recognize that I am a white cisgender man. And that comes with a whole lot of privilege. And so I feel a responsibility, you know, not to save anybody, but to use my time in support and uplifting people who have been marginalized and hurt. So, you know, we have very different stories in that regard, but ultimately it puts us on the same wavelength of, you know, we're here to lift people up.
Thank you for that. I mean, this is right up my alley, what you're talking about. It's so important as white people to do that. Yeah, and it's hard for a lot of people to do that. And so I appreciate hearing you both saying that.
Yeah, I think the most difficult threshold that I crossed was the threshold of believing that I'm an inherently good person. And once I realized, like, oh, I'm just human and I'm going to mess up. Mm-hmm. And the key is, how do I handle it when I mess up?
It's about realizing that learning opportunities are just that. And you know, it's an opportunity to learn. And if somebody presents you with that, it's a gift that they don't have to offer you. People can just leave if they don't appreciate how they're being treated. And if you can look at what's being offered to you and accept it as a gift, then you can improve and you can pass that on to other people.
I'm hoping that our listeners are really listening to this piece, because I was in an environment recently and the big word was F-E-A-R. You know, people had such fear of, how do you do this? I don't know what to say. So you just gave some great advice.
I see that fear among my peers. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm so worried of making a mistake. And it's like, you know what? You're gonna. And how do you handle that? That's what's important.
Well, it's how the people around you handle that as well. And if there is an acceptance that people are going to make mistakes, then being accepting of it when it happens, you know, as long as people aren't actually hurt, or if they are hurt, that work is done to repair that, generally things tend to work out better than they would have if you try hard to not do the wrong thing, because sometimes you have to push up against edges and discover where those edges are.
So listening to you, especially you, Josh, going to Evangelico summer camp and coming from right-wing views, I'm wondering how things are with your family now that you're married to Chris. How is that for you?
Here's the thing. My family is not right-wing, not even in the slightest. It was really simply that my dad was looking to help me. He didn't know how to help me. He accidentally connected me with a church that was judgmental. And so my family actually got worried about me, about how far I was taking that. And thank goodness, because they were part of the friction that helped me undo that and find a new path. So family is wholly accepting and loving and caring. And this isn't to say that they didn't have their own journeys to go through. None of us are born knowing everything. So they had to learn some things along the way. I'm very fortunate that my oldest brother came out well before I did. I have a couple cousins who came out well before I did. So the path had been well trodden. Yeah, very lucky.
How long ago was that when you came out? Since we're on coming out, let's talk about it.
Yeah, so I'm coming up on 14 years. I came out in 2008. I came out the night that Barack Obama was elected, which was a one set of feelings, and Prop 8 was passed. And I knew in that moment, I actually had a month prior to that, is National Coming Out Day. I had not really interrogated my sexuality in a long time, but I had long since lost my religion. And when National Coming Out Day came, it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. It's like, oh my gosh, all this time that I thought I was a gay person becoming straight. No, I'm bisexual. There's a word for this. It was so obvious. But in that moment, the realization was like, okay, well, that's good for me. I don't know if I'm ready to share that with the world yet. But by the time the election happened, it felt like I needed to come out. Like, it was only going to get harder and more awkward. And also suddenly my visibility really, really mattered, because I knew people who voted, in my view, poorly on Prop 8. And I needed them to know that I'm one of the people that they impacted with that. I'll lighten it up just a little bit. So that night I realized, like, okay, I got to come out. I was living at home with my mom at the time, and she had gone to bed, and I had some sleeping medication at the time, and I had taken my sleeping meds in preparation of going to bed, but then realized, oh no, I've got to go come out. And my mom, I've got to tell her first, because she's going to leave for work in the morning and she can't be the last to know. And so I wandered into my mom's bedroom, and if I could paint an image, it's dark. She's going to sleep, but the hall light is on. And so I pull up a stool by the side of her bed, and for me, it's all just silhouettes. And my sleeping medication was Ambien, which can cause some hallucination. And so this moment while I'm having a really earnest, heartfelt, meaningful conversation with my mom coming out to her as bi, all I see is just this shifting black mass of the shadows and silhouettes. And just, I'm just trying to hold it together. And like, I know that's just the medication. Everything's fine. So it's a strange coming out experience.
Yeah. Never to be forgotten.
No, never.
What about you, Chris?
Oh, complicated. So coming out was a long and drawn out process for me. I never really felt like it was a thing that I needed to do per se. Like, I hadn't really been in a deeply committed relationship in either direction. And so like, if I were to bring a boy home, I would have had to cross that bridge at some point. But like, it wasn't a thing that I felt particularly mattered about my identity so much. My views on that have changed somewhat since then, but that's how I was thinking about things at the time. And there came a point when I needed to talk to my parents about the fact that I was seeing this lovely guy in America and I was probably going to have to move. And that really did force my hand as far as family were concerned. And so that happened. But beyond that, it was just more of a, when it came up amongst friends, I said, yeah, I am mostly gay, bi, whatever it was I was deciding was my label at the time. It's complicated, as these things tend to be. But there was never really one moment, I guess.
Well, thank you both so much. We do have to end our interview. But before we end, we'd really like to ask each of you if you had words of wisdom for our listeners, something that you would like them to know. And each one of you will have an opportunity. Josh, you want to go first?
If there is any wisdom I have to offer right now, it is that all politics are local and everybody has a great opportunity to make a big difference in their backyard. Please pay attention to your school board races, to your sheriff races, to your DA races, to your supervisor races. There's an election coming up. It matters. Sometimes the national elections are just deafening. Just deafening. Please look past those. Pay attention to what's happening in your backyard.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, really.
Chris?
To build on that, look for opportunities to volunteer. Everyone brings a perspective that groups who need your perspective don't have. So go looking for those opportunities to build something that's bigger than what you are and find the people to do it with.
Beautiful.
I can tell that you both are so
passionate and wow, thank you so that we can feel your hearts.
Yeah,
thank you for that.
And we want everyone to remember, just like Josh and just like Chris, you too can be living proof that through sharing your wisdom and your experience and your passion and your vision, you can make our world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
What have you done today to make you feel around?
It's never too late to try.
What have you done today to make you feel proud?
Mm-hmm. You could be so many people.
Ooh.
If you make a grab for freedom.
What have you done today
to make you feel proud?
reflections of the fears I know I've left behind. Step out of the ordinary, I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way, can't stop me now, that you can do the same.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.